From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today, there are those who say we should defer health care reform once again, that at a time of economic crisis, we simply can't afford to fix our health care system as well. Well, let me be clear. The same soaring costs that are straining families' budgets are sinking our businesses and eating up our government's budget, too.
As President Obama convenes a summit on health care reform, we'll look at why the White House is rejecting a single-payer national health insurance program, then a debate on the International Criminal Court's decision to issue an arrest warrant for the president of Sudan. We'll host a debate between Harvard professor Alex DeWall and Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch. Then we'll look at the future of newspapers, 1 week after the Rocky Mountain News closed its doors after almost 150 years. And we'll get a report on the historic arguments before the California Supreme Court that'll decide the legality of the state's ban on same-sex marriage.
Proposition 8, if left unchallenged and is left as law, the end result is that there is no principal difference between being able to take away the rights of gays and lesbians to marry than to be able to take away the right of any other minority with regard to any other particular right.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama hosted a White House summit Thursday on reforming health care. Participants included doctors, health insurance companies, lawmakers, and patients. Obama vowed to make passing health care reform a priority this year. Those who attended included several lawmakers and lobbyists who successfully defeated former President Bill Clinton's attempts to partially reform health care in the 90s. The summit has raised controversy over the administration's apparent attempt to initially exclude any voices for single-payer health care. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The Obama administration has announced its first formal public overture to Iran. Speaking at a NATO summit in Brussels, Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton said the U.S. will invite Iran to a meeting on Afghanistan set for later this month. NATO, meanwhile, has also announced plans to resume formal contact with Russia for the first time since Russia's conflict with Georgia last summer. Clinton said U.S. disagreements with Russia endure.
NATO today agreed to restart the NATO-Russia Council as a mechanism for dialogue on issues both where we disagree, such as in Georgia, as the Secretary General noted, and a platform for cooperation that is in our interests, like transit to Afghanistan or non-proliferation.
Clinton also appeared to voice support for continuing the Bush administration's missile defense system in Eastern Europe.
We happen to believe in the United States that those threats in the future are more likely to come from regimes and terrorist networks than from nation states in the immediate vicinity. Therefore, we want to help Europe be prepared, and that's why what Poland and the Czech Republic have done sets the stage for what will be strategic decisions going forward.
The House has approved a measure that would allow bankruptcy judges to modify the terms of troubled home mortgages. Judges would have discretion to modify interest rates, reduce the principal, and extend the terms of a mortgage. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association, more than 11% of home mortgages are now in some form of distress. The bill now goes to the Senate, where it faces a tougher path to approval. The measure is a key part of the Obama administration's $75 billion foreclosure prevention plan, officially launched this week. The White House estimates the plan will assist up to 1 in 9 homeowners. The program offers financial incentives to mortgage servicing companies that let troubled homeowners modify their terms. And it calls for the government-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to refinance loans for those who don't owe more than 105% of their home's value. According to Moody's Economy.com, an estimated 13.6 million borrowers owed more than their home's worth at the end of last year. Meanwhile, the Senate's delayed a vote on a $410 billion appropriations bill. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he's one vote short of closing debate and sending the bill for President Obama's signature. The bill has come under opposition from senators opposed to what they call unnecessary earmarks and a provision easing U.S. travel restrictions to Cuba. The auto giant General Motors is warning it could go under within the next month unless it's given another taxpayer-funded rescue. The warning came after one of GM's auditors raised major doubts about the company's prospects for survival. GM is seeking another $15 billion in government loans on top of the $15 billion it's already received. In California, the state Supreme Court heard arguments Thursday in a case seeking the reversal of a voter-approved gay marriage ban. Proposition 8 amended California's constitution to limit marriage to a man and a woman, overturning an earlier court declaring the rule of gays and lesbians to marry, the right of them to marry. During a three-hour hearing, gay marriage advocates questioned the constitutionality of the amendment.
Petitioner's position is that Proposition 8 took away the fundamental right to marry from same-sex couples.
The right to marry or the right to get married?
Took away the fundamental freedom to marry, which includes the choice, the constitutionally protected choice about whether and whom to marry, and the ability to continue in that relationship.
The former Whitewater Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr represented backers of the gay marriage ban. During one exchange, Starr asserted voters have the authority to overturn constitutional rights, including free speech. We'll have more on Prop 8 later in the broadcast. The Senate Intelligence Committee has agreed to establish a review of the CIA's treatment of prisoners in the so-called War on Terror. The probe will focus on the imprisonment and interrogation of 100 prisoners in overseas jails. Most of the panel's work will be held in secret, and it's not expected to recommend filing any criminal charges. The Obama administration says it's launched a review of its policy towards Sudan in light of this week's International Criminal Court arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. White House officials say the review will include reconsidering the Bush administration's rejection of joining the International Court. Talk of potential U.S. admission to the Hague-based tribunal comes as the Bashir warrant is fueling talk of a similar action against former President George W. Bush. David Crane, a former prosecutor in the special tribunal that indicted Liberian President Charles Taylor, says the same principles that led to Bashir's indictment could be used against Bush on the issue of torture. Others have called for prosecuting Bush for the illegal invasion of Iraq that led to some 1 million deaths. We'll have more on the Bashir arrest after headlines. In military news, the Army says soldier suicides continue to follow a record trend. Up to 18 soldiers took their lives last month. That's down from the 24 soldiers who committed suicide in January, but still in line with the most number of suicides since record-keeping began. As many as 143 soldiers reportedly committed suicide last year. A U.S. military officer has been charged with stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars intended for relief and reconstruction projects in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon says Michael Dung Nguyen stole more than $690,000 while stationed in Iraq between April 2007 up until last month. And the CNN medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta, has withdrawn his candidacy to become the next U.S. Surgeon General. Gupta's nomination had been rumored for the past 2 months. He says he made the decision based on wanting to spend more time with his family. His potential candidacy had come under increasing opposition from groups opposed to his reporting that panned government-run health care. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. President Obama convened 120 experts to the White House Thursday for a summit on health care. Participants included doctors, health insurance companies, lawmakers, and patients. Obama vowed to make passing health care reform a priority this year.
In this effort, every voice has to be heard. Every idea must be considered. Every option must be on the table. There should be no sacred cows. Each of us must accept that none of us will get everything that we want, and that no proposal for reform will be perfect. If that's the measure, we will never get anything done. But when it comes to addressing our health care challenge, we can no longer let the perfect be the enemy of the essential.
While the president said every idea must be considered, the idea of creating a single-payer national health insurance program has already been rejected. White House spokesperson Robert Gibbs said Thursday the president doesn't believe that's the best way to achieve the goal of cutting costs and increasing access. Initially, no supporters of single-payer were invited to the summit. After protests were called, the White House invited Democratic Congressman John Conyers and the president of the Physicians for a National Health Program.
Single-payer advocates have also been largely silenced in the media. A new study being released today by FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, found the views of advocates of single-payer have only been aired 5 times in the hundreds of major newspaper broadcasts and cable stories about health care reform over the past week. No single-payer advocate has appeared on a major TV broadcast or cable network to talk about the policy during that period. Well, to talk more about this, we're joined by Luke Mitchell. He's senior editor at Harper's Magazine. His article in the February issue is called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Health Care System It Needs. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Luke.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
So why isn't single payer being considered? Why has it been rejected out of hand? Why do you think it's the only answer?
Well, it's amazing how out of hand it's been rejected. Max Baucus said a couple of months ago that everything is on the table. Max Baucus, the U.S. senator who's going to have a big hand in coming up with whatever reform we do see this year, said everything is on the table except single payer. He went out of his way to say that we can't have single payer. And I think there are a couple of reasons why they're so explicitly rejecting it. One of them is that it's a threat to a great deal of people who are making a lot of money right now, which is to say the insurance companies. A single-payer system would take a lot of money out of the insurance system, the private insurance system. And it's also something that a lot of people in Washington understand as ideologically threatening. That is to say, they equate a single-payer system with what they call, quote, socialized medicine, unquote. So I think what Obama is trying to do is neutralize that threat and get, as he said, the imperfect rather than nothing. And maybe he's right. There's clearly a massive resistance to single payer on the Hill.
And this is especially surprising given the fact, as you said in your article, that as recently as 2003, Obama himself said he favored single-payer
health
insurance.
That's right. That's right. When I started my Harper's article, what I wanted to understand is why this approach to health care, single-payer, which is used in most of the wealthy Western nations, which is much more efficient, which is much more equitable, which is much more amenable to making people healthy, is so far out of the mainstream in the United States. And I think what I found in the article was that it's purely a mental blockage. That is to say that even if you can make the argument, the practical argument for it, and we can talk about that in a minute, people still don't want it.
But we're in a different time.
Yeah.
The politicians have said that it's not doable before, but now we are facing a mass crisis, mass unemployment, tens of millions of people without insurance. Even those who have it are having trouble. I wanted to go to Obama yesterday, speaking about at this healthcare summit, the costs of healthcare. In a minute, we'll go to that. But the times have changed. We're talking about bailing out banks.
Yeah. Well, and indeed, this strikes me as a tremendous opportunity. On the other hand, the idea of universal health care was completely out of favor, 10 years ago as well. So we are moving in a positive direction. Just a few years ago, the president was able to found it politically feasible. President George W. Bush found it politically feasible to veto a bill that would insure children. That's changed.
I wanted to ask you about a company that you mentioned in your article in Harper's that most Americans have never heard of, but which may benefit a lot from all of this health care reform, especially since Obama is talking about computerization of medical records, using stimulus money for that. McKesson.
Yeah.
Who is McKesson, or what are they?
McKesson is the 18th largest corporation in the United States. I actually, when I lived in San Francisco, lived a few blocks from their headquarters, had never heard of them. And as I was researching my Harper's article, I came across a book by their CEO, John Hammergren, called Skin in the Game, where he was making an argument basically that was the opposite of the argument for single payer. He was arguing that when you use market solutions, you have a much more efficient system, which I did not find to be a compelling argument. But he, in making that argument, brought something else to light that was fascinating, which is that he wanted to have more information in the system. And that's what his company does. They make, among many other things, they process 80% of the prescriptions in the United States. That's more than eBay and Amazon combined in terms of processing individual orders. And they make all these various computer systems for communicating your health to your doctor and your doctor communicating your health finance to your insurer. That's obviously going to be a growing business. And one of the things Obama talked about today, yesterday, was making that business something that is more useful to people at the ends rather more useful to the people trying to make a profit from it.
Since single payer is almost never mentioned
yes.
in the media, just explain what it is.
Well, it's one of the phrases you hear about single payer is everybody in, nobody out. That is to say, in a single payer system, you don't have a system for deciding who gets treatment. So you have one payer, obviously, the single payer, usually the government, though it could be a government corporation or some other entity, like a utility. And
like Medicare, Medicaid.
Precisely. In fact, there's a bill, and this is the amazing thing. John Conyers actually wrote a bill several years ago, H.R. 676. It has 100 sponsors, more or less, on the Hill, and it's also known as the Medicare for All Act. And it would essentially expand Medicare to every American. The advantages of single payer are much more than just coverage, though. But it does solve the first moral problem, which is that there are 50 million Americans, now 46 because the Children's Health Insurance program has passed, 46 million Americans without insurance, and it immediately solves that problem. But it also introduces huge savings into the system because you don't have this massive overhead. And finally, it introduces smart incentives into the system. Right now, the incentive of a private insurer is to keep you healthy as long as you have insurance. And as soon as you don't have insurance, they don't care. So all Americans are going to enter Medicare at 65, even with supplements. And that means the private insurers don't have such an interest in keeping you healthy after you're 65, so they don't encourage things like smoking cessation or weight loss or any of the other things that they would do to keep you going. But it also, in private insurance, has a very strange incentive. Basically, the role of a private insurance company is to separate people who are going to get sick from people who are not going to get sick. They're very good at it. They use technology from companies like McKesson to do it. They're going to get better at it as we get better at understanding why people become sick with genetic and proteomic data. And what the insurance company's goal ultimately is to do is to create two perfect circles. One circle with people who never get sick and who have private insurance, and one circle with people who will get sick and don't have private insurance. Creating those two circles is very profitable. It takes a lot of money to do it, and it doesn't help a lot of Americans.
And yet, right now, they say it is unfeasible. The idea of having a middleman in the middle making a profit is what is being considered, even with universal health care.
Yeah.
Unless it were to change.
Well, you had mentioned Obama himself has said repeatedly that single payer is the best approach, but there are a lot of built-in players that need to be dealt with. And I think that's a true observation of reality in America today. And certainly the universal health programs we are seeing on offer right now basically act to bribe those middlemen into not complaining too much. What we have is a mandate system. Pretty much every Democrat who has proposed a system has said, we'll have a mandate, maybe a universal mandate, but it basically requires you to buy private insurance. If you can't afford the private insurance, the government will fund you. So it's not a market system exactly. It's basically government-funded private insurance. And the reason I think that people normal people might find that preferable is that normal people have a sort of a preference for what they think of as market solutions. They think this will somehow be more efficient.
Or perhaps this other system has never been explained to them before.
That's right. And
well, Luke, I just want to say thank you for explaining to us. We will continue to follow this issue, of course, one of the most important issues in this country today. And we will link to your article at Harper's Magazine. Luke Mitchell, senior editor at Harper's Magazine. His piece is called Sick in the Head, Why America Won't Get the Health Care System It Needs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, a debate on the issuing of an arrest order for the president of Sudan. Then we'll look at the same-sex marriage ban in California. And finally, we'll look at the history and the future of newspapers in this country as the Rocky Mountain News closes. Stay with us. Song Stand By Me from the award-winning documentary Playing for Change, Peace Through Music. People singing that song all over the world. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, for the first time, the International Criminal Court has issued an arrest warrant for a sitting head of state. On Wednesday, the ICC indicted Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir on 7 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, which included murder, rape, and torture in Sudan's Darfur region. The 3-judge panel said it had insufficient grounds for charges of genocide. Many Western human rights groups praised the arrest warrant, but the African Union and China warned the indictment could jeopardize the peace process in Darfur. Sudan has dismissed the charges and vowed not to cooperate with the World Court. Since the warrant was issued, Sudan has revoked the licenses of 13 foreign aid organizations, including Oxfam, CARE International, Doctors Without Borders, and Save the Children. The UN says Sudan's expulsion order removes 40% of the aid workers in Darfur.
To discuss the indictment of the Sudanese president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, we're joined by 2 guests. Richard Dicker is with us in our Firehouse studio, director of Human Rights Watch's International Justice Program. He led the Human Rights Watch multi-year campaign to establish the International Criminal Court. Alex DeWall joins us in Boston. He's program director of the Social Science Research Council, senior fellow at the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. In 2006, he served as advisor to the African Union mediation team for the Darfur conflict. He's author of several books on Sudan, including Darfur, A New History of a Long War. Richard Dicker, let's begin with you. Why do you think this is so important, what the ICC has done, the issuing of indictments against the Sudanese president?
Well, over the last 5-6 years of the conflict in Darfur, hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians have been slaughtered, have been subject to rape as a weapon of war and terror, and we have seen forcible displacement of whole populations. These are the most serious crimes, and for them, as part of ending the conflict and honoring those who have suffered, justice needs to be done, and the impunity that has been associated with these crimes needs to be brought to an end. The ICC decision of the other day is an important step in that direction.
Alex DeWall, you're skeptical about that decision. Tell us why.
I think there seems to be a bit of a gap in the argument here. On the one hand, as Richard Dicker says, the Sudan government is responsible for some of the most heinous crimes against humanity on the books. On the other hand, the assumption seems to have been among the ICC and its supporters that the moment an arrest warrant was issued, this same government would come along tamely, would submit. And there is a very serious downside risk to indicting a sitting head of state, in fact, basically indicting an entire government structure, when there are no measures in place, no mechanisms actually to protect the people in whose name this is being issued. And what have we seen over the last couple of days? We've seen a very predictable adverse response from that same Sudan government. Now, yes, we all support justice, but can justice be pursued at the expense of withdrawing essential humanitarian support that keeps millions of people alive? And I think that's a very, very real dilemma. And so my question is not should there be accountability, but should accountability in its timing, in its process, be weighed against other considerations. And I'd like to add that the rationale put forward by the prosecutor, Moreno Ocampo, for rushing through this indictment at this process was he said there is an ongoing genocide. Now, the judges found that there wasn't. There was no charge to answer on that case. And I think there's good reason for that. There were horrendous crimes were committed 2003, 2004, and they're not been remedied. But the UN data, the data from Genocide Intervention Network, et cetera, indicates about 150 people are being killed every month in Darfur. And that's bad. Perhaps half of them are being killed by the government and its forces. But that does not amount to an ongoing genocide. And I think that wouldn't be a surprise to Richard Dicker, because his organization, Human Rights Watch, has never said there's genocide in Darfur. So why the urgency of rushing this thing through at this moment, when a huge humanitarian operation is actually providing life-giving assistance, and we are imperiling that?
Richard Dicker.
Well, I think Alex makes some important and good points. And there are some of those points that I would agree with, in that there can indeed be a tension between peace and justice. I don't think any good comes from denying the tension of bringing about both peace and justice. And I also think Alex is correct when he flags for us the uncertainty. We don't know what's going to happen. No one is a clairvoyant here who can predict results one way or the other. But what I do take strong exception to in what Alex has just said is, first, his use of the term rush. My gosh, these killings in Darfur have been going on for 6 years. The Security Council asked the ICC prosecutor to begin an investigation and possibly charge individuals 4 years ago. It was back in July of 2008 that the prosecutor announced his request for a warrant, and only now, 8 or 9 months later, that the judges have rendered a decision. I think Alex's term rushed is ill-advised from the perspective of those who remain victims and have been victims. On the genocide count, I think Alex is correct. Human Rights Watch, on the facts that it gathered, has not found genocide. But I would remind Alex that widespread or systematic murder, torture, or rape doesn't amount to parking violations. Let's get real. These are the most serious crimes under law. So I wouldn't make too much of the fact that while the prosecutor wanted genocide charges, the court has found crimes against humanity, which are, again, torture, murder, rape, on a widespread basis, committed as part of a plan.
And practically speaking, what would this indictment mean in terms of actually bringing al-Bashir into a courtroom? Either, obviously, he would have to be arrested in international travel, or there has to be a change of government there for him to be actually brought to justice, no?
Well, I think, Juan, you have touched on, and Alex referred to, what is the well-known accountability Achilles heel of all of these international courts. None of them, unlike the court right around the corner here, has its own police force to enforce its arrest warrants and judicial orders. Nonetheless, we have seen in many diverse situations, ranging from Slobodan Milosevic, Charles Taylor, Radovan Karadzic, the apprehension of individuals. I mention those examples not to simplify and suggest that the situation in Serbia or Liberia is exactly the same as the one in Sudan. And I think Alex has made in his writings important distinctions. But nonetheless, all of these individuals have ultimately been apprehended. I think that will occur with Omar al-Bashir, and possibly we will see, and I say possibly, I'm not clairvoyant, a process of marginalization politically for Omar al-Bashir.
Professor Alex DeWall.
Ultimately, yes, very likely President Bashir will face some process of justice, but there is no mechanism. An internal coup d'etat in the Sudanese government, I don't think would be a very good idea, not least because the people who might mount it are themselves are cut from exactly the same cloth and have been involved in precisely the same sorts of activities as the president over recent years. Any other form of change in government by the military opposition would unleash a new war. So there is no mechanism for apprehending this fellow now. Meanwhile, there is a very complex negotiated transition to a democratic system in Sudan. There is a comprehensive peace agreement between the government in the north, headed by Omar al-Bashir, and the former southern rebels who've been brought into a government of national unity, ending more than 20 years of war. It's a very fragile, very difficult process. And that process requires cooperation between the existing government, its partners in government, the former rebels from the south, the SPLM, and the international community. And it's very unclear to me how the very difficult negotiated transitions, elections, etc., can proceed under these circumstances. There is, I think, also a very serious downside risk to the prospects of democratization and peace in Sudan as a whole, for the prospect of, as Richard says, ultimately bringing this one individual to court. So that's why I think the timing is poor. I think that this man is not going to be facing justice now. This is really a symbolic action. And why not postpone this until such time as the immediate crises have passed and the prospects of renewed war, of a reversion to dictatorship, etc., have been dealt with, have been put aside.
And Alex DeWall, what about the criticism raised by some that these international tribunals seem always to target weak or marginalized governments and don't go after, for example, in the Indonesian atrocities in Timor or the American atrocities in the Iraq war and its war on terror?
Well, I think this is something that the International Criminal Court needs to be very careful about, because in the initial days when it was set up, African governments, African peoples were great enthusiasts for the ICC, and more than half of the nations that became the first signatories to the Rome Statute that set up the court were from Africa. Three of the first four cases were referred by Africans. But Africa is now beginning to have serious second thoughts about the court. The African Union is strongly objecting to this arrest warrant. And of course, a lot of this comes down to sheer self-interest. They don't want the court looking too closely at what they themselves are doing. But part of it is a sense that the court has double standards and that there's a neo-colonial enterprise afoot. Personally, I don't see much evidence for that. But the perception of it, I think, is very important. And I think that if the court is really to have credibility, particularly in Africa, it needs to do a lot more work to support local, national processes of justice, and to be much more sensitive to the demands of Africans, that it works with them rather than being seen as some sort of alien imposition
from outside.
Let's
end on that point with Richard Dicker as well. David Crane, the former prosecutor in the special tribunal that indicted Liberian President Charles Taylor, says the same principles that led to Bashir's indictment could be used against Bush on the issue of torture.
Well, I think that really what is happening here is an extension of the reach of law. What applies for Bashir needs to apply for the leaders of the most powerful governments when they are implicated in these same kinds of crimes, and when, as has been the case in Sudan, the national courts, whose job it is, first and foremost, as Alex is rightly suggesting, have failed to do that investigation and prosecution. And I think where we're going with this whole international justice enterprise is towards a point in which it's not only African leaders or Serbian leaders. And I will agree with Alex, and I think he accurately flags the danger of perception. But where we need to move this ball down the field is that the Putins and the Bushes, for example, are just as much at risk for these kinds of international prosecutions as the leaders in Sudan or Liberia, et cetera.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you, Richard Dicker, very much for being with us of Human Rights Watch, as well, Alex DeWall at Harvard University. Among his books, Darfur, A New History of a Long War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. As we move now to California, Juan.
Well, in California, the supporters of a gay marriage asked the state Supreme Court Thursday to overturn Proposition 8 that amended California's constitution to limit marriage to a man and a woman. Last year, the court declared the rights of gays and lesbians to marry, but the San Francisco Chronicle reports the court appears ready to uphold the voters' decision to overrule the court and restore the state's ban on same-sex marriage. During a three-hour hearing, advocates of gay marriage questioned the constitutionality of the amendment, while supporters of the ban and argued that the court has no authority to overturn the wishes of the state's voters. This is attorney Raymond Marshall of the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, followed by former Whitewater Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr, who was representing backers of the ban on same-sex marriage.
What Proposition 8 does, and what it make it contend, is that this is a case which, for the first time, a ballot initiative has been used to take away a fundamental right from a suspect class.
We have heard an enormous amount by very able counsel about individual rights and suspect classifications. Those are very important topics. What we did not hear a lot from the other side is this inalienable right of the people of California, whether wisely or no, change the Constitution.
California State Assembly member Tom Amiano joins us now from San Francisco, longtime gay rights activist. He attended the court hearing on Thursday. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Assembly Member Amiano. Talk about the significance of these hearings, what you felt was most important.
Well, for me, sitting through this process with an activist background, it was very difficult to not speak out or yell out, because when Starr was up there, it just reminded me of how the Jewish people went to the courts during the Nazi regime hoping for relief. It's very bittersweet that, my side, the anti-Prop 8 side, they were so articulate and so impassioned, and, any reasonable person, I think, could deduct what the right thing to do was. But then when you hear someone like Kevin Starr, very, very moralistic, toying with words and with concepts and saying what you have now is enough and being so duplicitous. And unfortunately, many of the justices seem to buy into that, particularly one of the women justices who actually voted with us a year ago, being so defensive and so cloying, interrupting many of the opponents of Prop 8 with somewhat sarcastic remarks. It was very, very distressing. The other part of it is, I think we all have to take responsibility And the Prop 8 campaign, in and of itself, made up of many good people, just dropped the ball. And so one of the lawyers for our side said, don't make this public, but, you know, could you please make sure if we have to go back to the ballot that the same mistakes are not made? And I heard that loud and clear. Monday morning quarterbacking, you know, had we done more outreach, particularly to communities of color, had we personalized it more? I was around for Prop 6 when Harvey Milk was alive, and he actually debated, and there was a face put on the people who were going to be subject to being fired if they were teachers. I was one of them. It just seemed the campaign seemed to have more pith, where Prop 8, while it did accomplish many good things, also was had a large deficit in outreach and really directing that. $40 million was raised against Prop 8, and it still, you know, missed the prize by, you know, an agonizing 4 points, which I understand today would not happen. That there's been a lot, the defeat actually of our side actually educated a lot of people, and now they're saying they would vote against it, even though they voted for it at that time. So,
and when will the court actually make its decision?
They have 90 days. You could walk out of that courtroom yesterday and think they've already made that decision. However, you know, there's always a chance, there's always hope, there's always the feeling that particularly that one Justice Kennard was kind of grandstanding, playing to the House to show how she wasn't going to be bought out by emotion, et cetera, and so forth. And she could be doing that for show. But the you know, actually going through it and then going downstairs, you know, it was very ugly outside. You know, I'm used to all kinds of homosexuals are perverts and you're going to burn in hell. But there seemed to be a larger number this time, and they were unruly, and they had signs like the Dan White is a hero. And when we got up to speak to the crowd, they tried to shout us down, and, you know, they can't shut up a big queen. That's what I said to them. But it was very unsettling, and they have their children there with them.
Tom Mamiano, before we leave, you have also introduced a bill to legalize marijuana California as a means to raise revenue. California could go bankrupt. Talk about this bill.
Yeah, I'm very excited by it. It's an idea that's been around, John Vasconcellos in 2004, but it's never been introduced for the possibility of legislation. It would decriminalize marijuana, regulate it, and then tax it. There's a $14 billion marijuana industry that's no longer your, you know, avuncular hippie in Humboldt County, but large cartels in state parks, you know, shooting and killing by happenstance, you know, hikers who come upon their fortified plantations. Our Board of Equalization, which is our taxing body, estimates $1 billion could go into California's economy to our coffers. I just went through a brutal budget situation where we had to hold our nose and vote for all kinds of horrible things. California really is on the brink of economic destruction, and it seems so hypocritical. The war on drugs has failed. This industry is operating under everyone's nose, you know, not only capture the income, but also the ability to make a good public policy call here. And
Assemblyman Amiano, I want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to follow the state Supreme Court case. A couple days ago, thousands marched to lift the ban on same-sex marriage, and the hearings yesterday were watched on jumbotrons around San Francisco. We'll go out with the words of Sean Penn when he won the Oscar Award, talking about, of course, Harvey Milk. He starred in Milk.
Yes.
For those who saw the signs of hatred as our cars drove in tonight, I think that it is a good time for those who voted for the ban against gay marriage to sit and reflect and anticipate their great shame and the shame in their grandchildren's eyes if they continue that way of support. We've got to have equal rights for everyone.
What Proposition 8 does, and what it make it contend, is that this...
I never loved nobody fully. Always one foot on the ground. And by protecting my heart truly, I got lost in the sounds I hear in my mind. All of these voices I hear in my mind. All of these words I hear in my mind. All of this music, and it breaks my heart. And it breaks my heart. And it breaks my heart. When it breaks my heart.
The music, Fidelity, by Regina Spektor. We played the, for our TV audience, photographs. The Courage campaign asked its members to send in photographs of themselves with signs that read, please don't divorce us, or please don't divorce our friends, co-workers. They were inundated with 1,500 photos. The video has been viewed more than a million times, making it the most watched video of its kind in California history. You can watch some of it right here at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez-Juan.
Well, a week ago today, the last issue of the Rocky Mountain News hit newsstands across Denver. The paper's owner, E.W. Scripps Company, closed the Pulitzer Prize-winning paper to the shock of the paper's staff and readers. The 150-year-old Rocky was Colorado's first newspaper and the state's oldest continually operated business. This is how Rich Bain, the president and CEO of E.W. Scripps, broke the news last week to the staff at the Rocky.
One thing I just want to make sure and say, it's certainly nothing you did. You all did everything right. But while you were out doing your part, the business model and the economy changed, and the Rocky became a victim of that.
Other papers could soon face the same demise as the Rocky Mountain News. The owners of the San Francisco Chronicle, Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and Tucson Citizen are threatening to close the papers if new owners cannot be found. The owners of the Chicago Tribune, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the New Haven Register have sought bankruptcy protection. The Christian Science Monitor will soon become a web-only publication.
The New York Times and the Washington Post are also facing financial troubles. The Times recently had to borrow $250 million and is considering selling part of its new headquarters in Times Square. The Washington Post's fourth quarter earnings fell 77%. To talk more about the future of newspapers, we've got two guests. Laura Frank is with us, worked as an investigative reporter at the Rocky Mountain News up until last week. She joins us from Denver. And Bernie Lunzer is with us in Washington. He's the president of the Newspaper Guild. Let's begin with Laura Frank. Laura joining us from Rocky Mountain PBS. Tell us about what happened to the Rocky Mountain News, your paper.
Well, a week ago today, Amy, the Rocky published its last edition ever. In 55 days, we would have reached our 150th anniversary. But as you just heard the CEO say, the economy did us in, and so we ceased publication, and a great newspaper is dead.
Bernie Lunzer, I've heard estimates that as many as 12,000 journalists have lost their jobs in the last two years as a result of these downsizings and closings. What is the future for newspapers in the United States, and what is your union trying to do about it?
I think the future is troubled. The goal is to try to get to the other side, whatever that other side is. new products, new news organizations where distribution is on any platform that works. We're pursuing alternative ownership strategies. We're pursuing changes in the law that would facilitate bringing foundation money in. We're really working with any people that we can on forming alliances, on trying to find ways to sustain good journalism. But there are no guarantees right now. It is a very troubling and difficult time.
Laura Frank, you are in the process of starting up a nonprofit news organization. Talk about what your plans are.
Well, I think, like Bernie says, we're not entirely sure what is coming in the future. We've never been at a juncture like this before in our democracy. But I believe there needs to be a bridge so that the citizens continue to have the kind of in-depth investigative stories that we depend on that can be delivered to whatever platform is next, whether it's newspapers in some form, it's electronic, it's broadcast, whatever that is. So we are working with the University of Colorado as a partner to train young journalists and then deliver content to those media outlets that still exist in the state of Colorado, because this is an important part of our state, and the Rocky Mountain News was known for its in-depth and investigative work over the years, and we don't want to lose that in our state.
Can you talk about the piece you were going to have published in the Saturday Rocky Mountain News, which never came into being? I mean, you're very well known for your series, Deadly Denial, taking on the government's failure to take care of workers at nuclear testing sites like Rocky Flats.
I've been working on that story over the years, well, over the past decade. The story that was supposed to run Saturday was not about sick nuclear weapons workers. It was actually a follow-up to a series that I had worked on with several other reporters last year, a year ago December, looking at the giant oil and gas boom in Colorado and what that meant to the citizens of the state. And that was it was a tremendous impact on the state, both fiscally and socially, environmentally. I had gone back with another reporter to the other side of the Rockies, we call it the West Slope, and we actually wound up almost sliding off the majestic Rhone Plateau in a makeshift sort of road that had turned into a mudslide as a semi was coming down toward us. So we were quite glad we didn't die for a story that would never run. But the story looked at what the state had, the effects of the collapse of the economy on this oil and gas boom, and what had been a national controversy over whether to drill on the majestic Rhone Plateau had actually sort of fallen flat because the companies were leaving on their own.
Bernie Lunz, I'd like to ask you about the general importance of newspapers. Some people would argue that, well, with the web and with all the information that is available to the public now, maybe newspapers aren't as necessary as they have been in the past. But the issue of this independent local reporting and the number of people actually dedicated to coming up with stories is critical, isn't it?
Well, yeah, there's a huge misunderstanding right now. There's a belief that, you know, the newspapers are going to fail, so what? What most people don't realize is what a critical part of the news food chain newspapers and print really have been. It isn't the physical newspaper that matters so much as the content that it represents. The local coverage that could be lost in the next 10 years if there are no policy changes, if there's no new model for revenue, is really kind of frightening. And I would go so far, and I know it sounds cliche, but I think democracy itself would be very much at risk if you have a culture where people literally won't know what's going on. You know, they'll get entertainment news, they might get national news, they'll get some of the things that they can get, but they may literally know nothing about their local community.
Now, back in the 70s, the government introduced the Newspaper Preservation Act as one way to deal with failing papers at that time. Could you talk about that act and what it was able to accomplish?
Well, the act certainly it allowed for joint operating agreements, so you could get two newsrooms to, that could basically operate separately, put out two separate products, but they would have one business entity. So all their advertising and all the commercial side was commingled, co-joined. The problem with it was it really was perhaps it did preserve some products like the Rocky. It preserved the Seattle PI for a period of time, but it still didn't it didn't solve the problem, and it did in some cases. It still let the owners believe that they had a monopoly on a market when it came to ad rates and things like that. So it maybe it forestalled the problem, and then of course the web came along and changed all the dynamics.
Laura Frank, you wanted to get a word in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I think that Bernie makes a good point, and I want to tell you about an experience that we had several times over the past 2 months. You know, Scripps announced December 4th that the Rocky Mountain News was for sale, and everyone knew right away that that would likely mean, in this atmosphere, closure. And we would get letters and calls and emails and comments on our website saying, gosh, it's terrible that the newspaper may go away, but don't worry, we'll keep reading you on the web. I think a lot of consumers of news on the web don't realize where that information is coming from. And the way that news tends to work in this country is that it surfaces at the level of local newspapers. And sort of percolates its way up. And so to get information to the masses, we really depend on those local, in most cases, those local newspapers. So we've not seen before in this democracy what is happening today.
And Laura, even the papers that are surviving with fewer actual reporters who go out there and get the news, and more of the people now. I know that in many daily newspapers now, it's the websites are the only ones that are growing. The people who design the websites, who regurgitate the news that they found someplace else. So even those that are still around, the actual number of people who go out in the streets to gather the news is declining rapidly, isn't it?
You know, on the week before the Rocky closed, I did a quick survey. And in Denver, in the last 2 years alone, there had been at least 25 investigative reporters, editors, and producers who were no longer working, no longer with eyes and out there watching out for what was going on. With the closure of the Rocky, you can add, you know, at least 10 or 12 more classic investigative reporters to that list. But if you look at the overall number of reporters that have been lost in this city in the past couple of years, you're probably looking in the hundreds. And that is not something that's been happening over several years. It's not something that happened just last week with the closure of the Rocky. You're right. It's something that's been happening across the country in incremental ways over the past 10 years.
Who will hold the government accountable, Laura Frank?
Well, we still have one newspaper. We still have some TV stations. We have citizen journalists. And we hopefully soon have the nonprofit Investigative News Network that we're working on. And we hope some combination of that will continue to hold officials accountable. Even the mayor of Denver, at the announcement of the closure of the Rocky Mountain News, said, look, it's not, I'm paraphrasing him, but he said, it's not always pleasant to be the subject of the spotlight of public examination, but it's an important thing. And we all realize that, and we need it to continue to happen. So we're going to have to figure out a new way to work it. But I don't think it's entirely new. I mean, citizens have always been a part of the news as it percolates up, as I said. And so I think that we're going to have to figure out a way to make sure that still happens and people are paying attention right now. This the death of the Rocky Mountain News has gotten attention not only here in Colorado, but throughout the nation. And in fact, I did an interview yesterday with multimedia news in Bogota, Colombia. This has really been a wake-up call for people. So I'm hoping that
Bernie Lunzer,
there may be some good that comes out of it.
I'd just like to ask Bernie, we have about 20 seconds left. You were talking about possible new models that involve foundation and for-profit models. Could you quickly give us a quick sense of that?
Well, if you Google the term L3C, you'll see that we're trying to push forth legislation that creates a socially oriented a for-profit company that can take nonprofit foundation money. So on that level, we're trying to mix for-profit and nonprofit. We think it's a major change in the LLC structure, and we think it has huge potential for the market.
We want to thank both of you for being with us. Bernie Lunzer, president of the Newspaper Guild, speaking to us from Washington, and Laura Frank, a former investigative reporter at the Rocky Mountain News. Her husband also worked at the Rocky Mountain News, which closed last week, would have celebrated its 150th anniversary this next month. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fotokadu Saramate, Angela Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Peter Curries, our engineers. Special thanks also to Nick Gillihue, Grant, Samantha Chambly, Jessel. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.